Ernest Hemingway first visited Sun Valley in the fall of 1939, and he kept returning for the rest of his life. He worked on For Whom the Bell Tolls and A Movable Feast in the Wood River Valley. Some of his best years were spent in Idaho, but his final days were also in the home that he and his wife, Mary, lived in. It's along the Big Wood River. The Hemingway House is managed by the community library as a contemplative, creative, non-commercial space. It is the site of ongoing research and a residency program for writers and scholars and artists. Our Morning Edition host, George Prentice, got to drop by to visit the house. And this quick note, George will be talking about suicide and depression in this conversation. So let's travel to the Wood River Valley with George.
First of all, good morning.
Good morning.
How are you?
I'm well. How are you? At the Hemingway House, our host, Jenny Davidson, Executive Director of the Community Library. Well, how do you see this? Is it the property of the library? What is the relationship between the home and the library?
Right. The Community Library Association is the custodian,
of
the house. And the library does own the house. I like to think of it in terms of custodianship because it really is a matter of caring for something that has a life that is very expansive, there's just so much interest in Hemingway's work and in his life. And it is so interwoven with our local history here, that I think the word custodianship really best conveys that.
Joining us, Mark Ott, Hemingway scholar. In fact, we were joining him. He has been an artist in residence. Yes, that means spending his days and nights in this home. And if these walls could talk.
Okay. So you've had a few evenings here.
Solo.
Yeah. No, I think it's very powerful to be here by yourself. This house itself becomes a key that unlocks many things in that last chapter in his life, right? As you see, this is kind of the unfortunate conclusion to such a rich life, right? And on the one hand, it's a beautiful home, especially from the interior. And you think too, I mean, I honestly just keep looking at that space over there and just feeling a vibration that, you know, he says one night, he says the night before, good night, sweet kitten, to Mary, you know, and she's still asleep at 7 o'clock in the morning. And then she hears what sounds like a drawer being pulled out, which is actually Ernest firing a shotgun. And it happens right here in this space.
Much of our relationship with Hemingway is a romantic relationship. But time goes by, and we want to know more. But when we do know more, it becomes more complex. Could you talk about this delicate balance, or maybe indelicate balance, of the romantic and the complexity of Hemingway?
It is that delicate balance or friction, I would say, that makes it compelling, that makes it seem possible and necessary for an organization like the Community Library to continue to attend to Hemingway. If it was only the romantic vision, I don't think that would be very interesting, actually. That's pretty flat. And you see in his literature and in his life, struggling with both what is hard and ugly about existence, and also what is so exquisitely beautiful and touching. I feel not at all inclined to shy away from that darkness, but like that is a gift for us to be able to explore it. To me, that is why we have literature, because life is messy and we are constantly trying to make sense of it. And it's literature like works of Hemingway's and the tens of thousands of books that our libraries hold throughout the state that help us to consider life, to make sense of it from many different perspectives and many different points of view. And Hemingway's life really embodies that, and particularly because he became such an iconic figure at the time that he lived. I think all writers have their complexities. There is a visibility and a cosmopolitanness to Hemingway that really brings all of that to the fore. We feel like the fact that he died here, and he died by suicide, that he was struggling with depression, paranoia, that he was losing his memory as he's writing a memoir. You know, these are challenging paradoxes, and you know, also in a place where he came at the height of his powers. You know, when he first came to Sun Valley in 1939. He was it. I mean, there was a reason Sun Valley invited him. Like, who could be better to bring here than Ernest Hemingway, who had published at that time A Farewell to Arms, The Sun Also Rises. These had been critically acclaimed as well as popularly acclaimed. He was vigorous. He was adventurous. He was handsome. So he comes here at the height of his powers and immediately becomes friends with people who are kind of the ordinary folks here and is friends with them through the rest of his life. And then he comes here at his most vulnerable, when he really feels like the world is out to get him, when his writing has become increasingly uneven, when he has been married four times and those marriages have all been deeply flawed endeavors. And so I'm interested also in, what does this say about this place? What does it say about a community to be able to be elastic enough to encompass both, to be a place that can celebrate with you and a place that can also absorb your grief? I think that's pretty powerful to think about.
But to be good stewards is also, I mean, there's a reason why this isn't open 6 days a week for, you know, X dollars admission, so that people can say, oh, that's where he shot himself. And it doesn't become that carnival.
Right. Right. We don't see this as a place of spectacle. We see it as a place of reverence. And right now, we think that the way that this house can be of best service to the broadest community and to honor Hemingway's legacy itself in a way that feels truest to us is to focus on the preservation of the house and the materials in it. And that is a big project. And we do educational outreach. So we do have school groups.
I guess that's my next question is and then, so when is the public invited?
Yeah. So we, through educational endeavors, we do have some school groups that come. Like when we had a group of sixth grade students who remarkably were reading The Old Man and the Sea, and they attend Hemingway Elementary, and they came and sat on the lawn and talked about that book. And I thought, how meaningful for them, these young people, to look out at these mountains and think, not only is this a place where, you know, a peekaboo street can be formed, but an Ernest Hemingway as well, that this is an intellectual and creative landscape as well as an athletic landscape. I think that really matters.
So can we talk just a little bit more about your experience, and tell me when this is none of my business. Let's say your first evening here. Do you meditate? Do you sit? Do you just...
It was too powerful. I just didn't want to be in this space by myself. It was dark. There was, I could hear elk in front of me as I'm walking up the ice-packed, snow-surrounded road to this really dark house, which still stood out against the white snow. And then I walk in, and I'm like, I am alone. And so to be in this space, you know, by myself, and then just to think about listening to it, the house, you know, that it was quiet. And I wouldn't want to use the word ghost. I'd say spirit, right? That sense of vibration within the space, that something very powerful had happened here. And it also just resonates with just, you know, I think for understanding the complexity of Hemingway, and that's the thing that I try to convey to my students. It's like, you don't want to be Hemingway, but you want to understand how he developed that magic creativity, how he had that endless curiosity, how he was able to connect with so many human beings and form instant friendships, and to identify every bird that he sees, right? To appreciate all these wild creatures and the wild beauty of nature. To me, that's what I want to convey to students, is just to have that openness to the human experience and this endless curiosity. What I tell my students, again, is he was a B-ish student in high school, right? And he graduates, but within 5 years, he's creating short stories that endure forever. And so that ability to, right, be your own teacher and to follow your own creativity and to have an active creative life is a powerful lesson to students and to people everywhere.
Hemingway scholar Mark Ott and Jenny Davidson, executive director of the Community Library in Ketchum. We should always note that help is available at the Idaho Suicide and Crisis Hotline. It is 988, and online at idahocrisis.org.
And that was our Morning Edition host, George Prentice, up in the Wood River Valley. Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is Chip Brantley, co-host of the NPR podcast White Lies. Before we found the man in Vancouver, before we sued the State Department, before we snuck into the graveyard of a federal penitentiary, all we had were the photographs. Photographs of a group of Cuban men standing on the roof of a prison in rural Alabama. That's this season on the NPR podcast White Lies.